Welcome to a special and sad edition of 100% Hockey. John Shannon here, joined by NHL.com columnist and NHL historian Dave Stubbs on the passing of Ken Dryden. By the way, Dave's outstanding work on Ken is up at NHL.com. And Dave, I really appreciate you taking the time on this weekend to talk about what Ken Dryden meant. I think my first question is, when you consider he was a player that won six Stanley Cups in eight seasons, I would argue that he had a better impact, a bigger impact, when he stopped playing the game. Would that be fair?
I think that's absolutely correct. Kenny certainly marched to his own drummer his entire life. And I've been saying in the past days since his passing shocked all of us that where hockey defines the lives of many professional hockey players, hockey was only a piece of Ken Dryden. Ken loved the game. He loved his teammates. He loved the games. He loved everything about the game. But it was only a very small part of his life in the end. When you start to look at what he accomplished afterwards, you know, from his law degree to his television work to his writing to his book, 1983's book, The Game, I mean, which is the landmark book in hockey, right? I mean, it's certainly the greatest hockey book ever written, and it has to be one of the best pieces of sports literature ever produced. Ken's work in the provincial government in Ontario, being, you know, a member of parliament, I mean, just all of these incredible things that he did. Ken had so many irons and so many fires. It's you never, ever saw him gathering moss. He was always on the go. He always had a project. And he always had a bit of a gleam in his eye when you talked to him, because he always had something going on that he wasn't going to tell you about until it came to fruition. And suddenly he'd say, wow, I couldn't believe you had the time to do this one as well.
You're a Montrealer. He played there for so many years. When did you first come in contact with him?
Well, my first contact with Ken Dryden would have been as a fan in my teens, watching him do what he did in the 1970s with the Canadians. He just was remarkable. I didn't like Ken at first because he's the guy who sort of shoved my childhood boyhood, Rogi Vachon, out to Los Angeles. I talked to Rogi yesterday, and Rogi said, listen, I mean, we got along famously. We were very good friends. But when I knew he was coming and I saw how good he was, there was really nothing that I could do about that. And so he said, I wanted to start. I wanted to play. And with Ken Dryden doing what Ken Dryden was going to do in Montreal, there was not going to be a place for me other than sitting on the end of Scotty's bench. So he went out to Los Angeles, but Ken was just incredibly special. And the thing that was so good about him, despite the fact that he had the big three in front of him, despite the firepower of the Montreal Canadiens, he might've had some games where he wasn't getting, you know, this absolute shooting gallery of pucks, but he had to be sharp. So he would sit in conversation with Jerry Cheevers yesterday. He'd say he would just sort of be there inactive at the end of the rink where the Zamboni didn't have to come and basically resurface the Habs end some nights. But all of a sudden there'd be a flurry of two or three or four shots, and he had to be sharp before the Canadians could grab the rebound and then go the other way. So it was amazing to watch him as a teen and as I grew, and then watched him retire basically in his prime. I mean, if maybe a little past his prime, he could have played another half dozen years, probably, John, right? I mean, he wasn't done in 1979 at the age of 31. He had a lot of hockey left in him, but he had so many other things that he wanted to do in life that it just made sense for him in his mind at that time to move on and to try to do some other things.
You know, the fascination for me was that I knew Ken when he played for Montreal, and then obviously we worked together at Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment at the turn of the century.
Right.
But so much of what was driven by Ken was what he was instilled in him by his parents. You know, Margaret and Murray were great philanthropists, great charitable people. They ran a nonprofit that 100% of the revenue went directly to the charity without taking salary. If you wanted to work for the nonprofit, you had to pay your way. And the whole concept was that of giving. And that did appear to be part of what made Ken so strong, was his ability not only to perform, but to give back. And that's, in my mind, one of the great things about his life after playing, was that he always wanted to give back, whether it was to the game of hockey, or whether it was to the Canadian public, but Ken always wanted to give back. Did you get that sense?
Oh, very much so. Ken very much enjoyed being in the public eye in the sense that he loved
hockey.
He did
like the public eye, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And you know what? He was just a very different guy, right? He was not going to be necessarily the statesman that Jean Béliveau was. He wasn't going to be sort of the magnetic personality that Guy Lafleur was in this town. But when Ken Dryden was out and about and was among us, I mean, fans just flocked to him, and they loved to sit and get a piece of Ken for even that couple of moments. They might have needed a decoder ring for the conversation after they left, because I mean, Ken didn't speak the same way most hockey fans or most of us did. And I've kind of touched upon this. I said that Ken Dryden was a reporter's dream and a nightmare at the same time. If you are working for the afternoon newspaper, if you're Red Fisher in Montreal and you have an afternoon deadline, then you can sit and listen to Ken Dryden forever. If you're working for the Montreal Gazette and you have a 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. deadline and Ken is your guy in the dressing room, if he's your story of the night, good luck to you getting in and out of there with a soundbite, because Kenny never spoke in soundbites. He spoke in long, eloquent paragraphs, very flowery, and he just had a different insight. He just had a different analysis of the game. He saw things very, very differently, and it was great to actually sit with him at length and let him just sort of spread his wings a bit and talk about the game and talk about the insight and why the game was special to him and to the fans, as they should have seen it, perhaps in a little bit of the way that Kenny did.
In your opinion, where does he fit in amongst the great goaltenders in franchise history?
Well, it's got to be right near the top, right? I mean, you know, you go back to the very early guys, to the George Vezinas and the George Hainsworths at the start. I mean, very different rules, very different equipment, just everything. You can't ever compare eras of goaltenders because that position has changed so much. The game has changed so much, John, right? But, you know, goaltending, you look at some of the ratty old stuff that goalies then wore. You look at some of the stuff that Ken wore. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, there's some photographs of him wearing this basically a glorified first baseman's mitt. It was a little better than that. It was a Cooper catching mitt, but because his wrist would perspire, he had the trainer, Eddie Palachek, fit this piece of Velcro to clamp it around his wrist. You saw his pads, and I mean, they were ludicrous compared to what those guys wore. I mean, Kenny was a stand-up guy, and he said, I figured in his day, he thought the best, the safest way to play goal was to stand up. And he said, you know, you get the idea that sometimes then you see a guy like Tony Esposito starting to pioneer or develop the butterfly that Glenn Hall had developed, and there was just a different way to play the position. But Ken was incredibly acrobatic based on his size. I mean, there were no 6'4" goaltenders. I mean, Scotty Bowman spoke to this yesterday. He said you had guys like Gump Worsley and Charlie Hodge and Rogie Vachon. These were guys who were like 5'7", 5'8". They had to be incredibly acrobatic. Well, Ken just knew he could read the position. He knew how to play the position. And Cheevers was really interesting yesterday in that he said that he knew how to develop, he knew how to play that position and where his defensemen were and how he could kind of move around and guide them. And he was very, very, as quiet as he was with a lot of us, he was very vocal on the ice. He was letting his defensemen know who needed to be covered, who had to be cleared out of the way. And Larry Robinson was speaking to the fact that he absolutely hated, for some reason, Eric Vail. He thought that Vail was just one of those guys with Atlanta who just had his number. And he'd be yelling and screaming at Larry Robinson, keep out of the way, keep out of the way, because he wanted to see the puck from Vail. I checked it out. Vail only scored 3 goals and had 3 assists, I think, lifetime on him. But Kenny seemed to think for some reason that Vail had his number. So he was. It was interesting how he worked with his defensemen.
And, you know, there's a career with Canadians, but there's also that, and I do view December 31st, 1975 as a different date too than sure. than a Montreal Canadiens game. So there's the 72 series, and then there's New Year's Eve against Red Army, head-to-head with Tretiak. And no one seemed to relish playing international hockey more than Ken Dryden.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and people talk about that 75 game, and I've heard people say it was the greatest game ever played. I mean, I'll argue that it wasn't. I mean, it was a very one-sided hockey game, and Vladislav Tricek stood on his head, and Ken has had much better nights in goal than that one, and everyone admitted that. I think Red Fischer walked into the dressing room, sat down beside Dryden and said, Ken, you blew it. And Ken kind of admitted, yeah, like I did. I was not good tonight. But what Ken did, I mean, you figure he plays game one in the Summit Series and they light him up and Montreal fans are not happy and they're all over his case. Well, Phil Esposito yesterday spoke to the fact that he said, look, I didn't speak the same language as Ken Dryden. I speak the way I speak and Ken spoke like a lawyer. He said, but he came back and he listened in the dressing room. He knew what he had to do. And he's the guy who we went to in game 8 in Moscow. And he's the guy who played a strong game and gave us a chance to win. And Ivan Cornoy spoke to that yesterday, too. He said, Kenny always gave us a chance to win the game.
Well, of course, it was 5-3 after the second period. And I think the whole country was still mad at Ken for letting in 5 goals in the first 2 periods. But when it mattered, that third period in Moscow, he didn't allow any goals and allowed the Canadians to come back and win 6-5. So, and we, you know, the other aspect of it for me is, and I'm a selfish broadcaster, is that he was that second voice in Lake Placid, right? Al Michaels is Do You Believe in Miracles? And that voice that chimes in is that of Ken Dryden, who worked for ABC. Doing Olympics for at least 3 times, 80, 84, and 1988 in Calgary.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I was in Tampa at the All-Star Game. Was it 2018, I think? And Ken Dryden, I'm actually riding the elevator down from the upper levels with Ken. The door stops one flight down. It's just the two of us on the elevator. And Stinger, the mascot from the Columbus Blue Jackets, walks on. And Ken looks at him like he's his long lost friend. He says, I know Carlton the Bear. I just wanted to help. You know, Carlton and I are good buds in Toronto and so on. And how are you? Of course, you know, Stinger's just standing there with his dopey look on his face. Of course, the mascot's not going to talk. And the door's open. I told Ken, I said, you're not leaving unless I get this picture. And here's Ken, this buttoned down executive who we all kind of know is this serious guy. And I get the picture of this goofy mascot grinning and Ken with a big smile on his face. We turn around the corner and there's Al Michaels. And so I said, we need to have this one too. So the two of them just talked and it was a bit of a reunion for them. And so Ken was he was a fun voice and a very informative voice in the broadcast booth. And that's what I always had with Ken. Any conversation I had with him, no matter the topic, I came away informed, I've been educated, and I've learned something about the game that I never knew, whether it was a 1-minute conversation or a 1-hour conversation.
I think there's a lot of people that never understood how much fun Ken could be.
Yeah, he had a wonderful sense of humor. I mean, it was absolutely fabulous. I mean, and because he was this sort of buttoned down guy, as I mentioned, I mean, Guy Lapointe took full advantage of that because Guy was one of the absolute prime world-class practical jokers and famously nailed Ken Dryden's cowboy boots to a bench in the Canadiens' dressing room. Well, you know, Ken wasn't going to give Guy the satisfaction. So instead of getting the boots resold, he just stuffed them full of paper towels and wore them through Montreal slush the rest of the winter. So, you know, I mean, Ken just had this great, and no one had a better sense of humor, self-deprecating sense of humor than Ken. Nobody could poke more fun at Ken than he could himself. And I remember asking him during some sort of rambling conversation, I said, what did you spend your first professional hockey earned dollar on? And there was a long pause and he said, well, there may be some less generous people in this world who feel that this has yet to happen. So, I mean, now Ken just saw things differently. He just had a different way to poke fun at himself. But yeah, he was a very, very fun guy when you got him talking about something off the game. If he was talking about a special project he had or something that had some gravity that he was going to let the gravity of that situation carry it, then fine. But if you got Ken onto something weird and wonderful, like his love of Monty Python's Flying Circus or you know, Gary Larson's The Far Side comic strip, I mean, he just had a blast and he would have a lot of fun with that.
I couldn't help but find today on social media that famous shot of at the Buffalo Auditorium of Ken and Dave shaking hands at center ice after the game. And quite frankly, how much that meant to Ken and meant to Dave and meant to the family, that the two Dryden brothers played against each other. And one aside, when I was running Hockey Night in Canada, I was in a hotel room in Denver, and the phone rang, and it was Ken, and he wanted to sell me a two-part series. This is after they transformed his book, The Game, to an eight-part series on the CBC, which was, to me, right, as good as the book, because
yeah, for sure.
Ken made sure it was as good as the book. And Ken tried to sell me a two-part series on goalie masks and how, in his opinion, goaltending had changed from protection to prevention, which was one of his favorite lines. And he wanted to talk about how his brother had really changed goalie masks and gone to the cage more so than anything else. And he wasn't looking for attention for himself. He was looking for attention for his brother, who he felt didn't get very much credit for what Dave Dryden gave back to the game. Because Ken got all the credit, and nobody...
Sure, absolutely.
The older brother ended up being, oh, he's Kenny's brother. But really, Dave was Ken's hero.
Well, when Dave and Ken faced each other in Montreal, they were never supposed to play against each other.
Was it Montreal, not Buffalo?
Well, it was Montreal, because Punch Imlach was coaching the Sabres, and he wanted the Dryden brothers to play against each other. Well, I think that I've forgotten who it was. I guess the Canadians started Rogie. And so Punch started Dave, and then he went to his other goalie. I've forgotten who it was. Joe Daly, maybe? I don't remember.
Al Smith, maybe?
I think it was Al Smith. Yeah, so that's how it starts. Rogie gets hit in the nether regions with a shot, has to leave the game, and so in goes Ken. Well, immediately, then Punch throws in Dave. Well, the mask that Ken is wearing in that is one of the sort of fibrous sport Jacques Plante-style masks. It wasn't the familiar mask that he wore. And I asked him about that later on. He said, look, I'm sitting on the bench. I don't expect to play. For some reason, I have that mask. I get the call to go in. So he said, I'm not going to say to Eddie Palchuk, I'm just new to the team. I'm not going to say to Eddie Palchuk, hey, go back and get my regular pretzel mask. And so I go in wearing that. And then he said, I would have felt embarrassed if I had come up with a different mask when I came back out for the next period. So that's the mask that he actually has in his hand for that one. And over my shoulder, you may see there's a replica of Kenny's pretzel mask. I had a really, really nice replica done. And in 2007, when Ken had his number retired at the Bell Centre, I took that to the arena, and Ken signed the forehead of that. And that is a cherished piece for me. It's in my home office, and I look at it very differently now, more than ever, with Ken no longer with us.
Well, of course, there are so many ways that he touched the game. I mean, with his writing, with his playing. The great Ken Danby's, you know, famous in the crease. That is Ken Dryden.
Sure it is. Yeah, yeah. And that magnificent statue outside the Hall of Fame. That big statue that's right outside the gift shop at the Hall of Fame. That's spectacular. I mean, that's one of the great photo opportunities in Toronto, right? For any fan.
Absolutely. So it's his impact is something that, and I think as you and I touched on this morning before we went on the air, the appreciation for Ken Dryden over the last couple of days has been amazing.
It really has been. And you know what? I think Ken left this world very much the way he lived his professional and his personal life, gracefully, quietly, somewhat privately, obviously. No one knew that Ken had been battling cancer beyond his family. I mean, the alumni of the Montreal Canadiens and opposition players who I spoke with yesterday were stunned. Larry Robinson was he couldn't even find the words. Sarah Savard spent a good long period of time with Ken last February in Montreal during the Four Nations face-off, and he had absolutely no idea. And so Ken was battling this very privately. I'm sure he spoke to Linda and spoke to his kids and said, this will be a private family thing. And when the time comes, then you can do what you can do. So Linda would have communicated the news to Scotty and to Sarah Savard, who then took it up the ladder to the Canadians, and the Habs, of course, announced it just after midnight on Friday night. And Saturday morning, this city just literally had its breath taken away. No one had any idea that Ken was ill. And, you know, you're happy that he was able to go out on his own terms. But I guess the other side of that coin is that people just never had a chance to kind of say goodbye in any fashion. But I think that Ken Dryden understood the love that he had from fans and the respect that he had from his peers and from opponents through the years in the game of hockey and well beyond the arenas, John. Just the outpouring of love and affection and respect that we've been hearing for Ken Dryden in the last 24, 48 hours has just been absolutely amazing.
Couldn't have said it any better, David. Thank you for your time.
John, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Great seeing you always.
NHL columnist and historian Dave Stubbs in Montreal. We will be back with the legend, Scotty Bowman, after this. Welcome back to 100% Hockey, joined now by Hockey Hall of Famer, NHL's winningest coach, Scotty Bowman, who, when he took the job in Montreal, he knew a few things. Guy Lafleur was going to score goals. He had great defensemen, and he had number 29 in goal, Scotty, right?
Yeah, he had that big series the year before I got there. That's true. Yeah, I got quite a story about that, how he, you know, he was playing in Montreal with the Voyageurs.
Right. And Al McNeil and Mr. Pollock, I guess, decided to go with him in the playoffs, gave them the best chance to win, and they upset the Bruins.
Well, the good story that Ken always told me about is when they had it's the only year the Voyageurs played in Montreal, then they moved to Halifax, and they, you know, he was going to McGill at the time, McGill University, so they made an arrangement he would play the home games, plus he would play games in Quebec City because they were in the league. Quebec was I think a farm team of Philly mm-hmm. in the American League, so. I guess he played about 30-something games that year, and he was in his exam week, but there was a game in Quebec City. And I think what happened is he went to the game, and he had the worst game of his career. He got beat by 6 or 7 goals, and when he got back into Montreal the next morning, and there was a message from Sam Pollock, please come down to see me at the Forum. And he said to me, I was expecting the news that this system wasn't going to work anymore about me just playing home games. And he said, Sam asked him, how are you doing in school? He said, I just finished. He said, in fact, I probably shouldn't have played the other night. And he said, well, I got a plan. And the Canadians were third that year. And of course, Boston was way, I think that's the year Boston won like 59 games or something.
That was by far their best regular season in that run there, Scotty.
So Sam said, we got a trip coming up. We got 6 games. I'd like to take you on the trip and start you play a few games to see what we could do. Well, he played every game. They didn't lose a game. It's amazing. I mean, they didn't lose a game. And that's that's the history series that everybody can remember, eh, John? I mean, game 7 too in Boston. Imagine that. He won the Stanley Cup before he ever played a regular season game.
Yeah, won the Conn Smythe Trophy and then won the Rookie of the Year the next year.
Yeah, and then the next year he won the Calder. Right. He won the Rookie of the Year. We didn't do very well. I got beat by the Rangers, and then the next year. Well, then he took I was looking at his record the other day. Actually, it was about 2 weeks ago. Somebody called and asked about goaltending, and I said, let me see the stats on this goalie. And, you know, I think if I'm correct, John, he missed the game the year after the 73 Cup. He was going to go. He went back to Toronto mm-hmm. because he was articling for his degree, his law degree. And he was also, I understand from, I didn't know at the time, the contract difficulties. So he didn't play that year. And when he came back the next year, was his highest percentage goals against. I think it was like 2.4 or something. But then he only played, I think when you look at it, if you look, forget about the cup in the first one in 71. And the other, he won 5 cups in 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I looked at his record. He lost 57 games out of 2 less than 400. Wow. It was a record. I mean, nobody ever talked about that, that he won all those games. And then the playoffs, the same thing again. He won 80 games in the playoffs and lost 24. So I mean, I know the team was great, but even some of the players would say now, I'm sure, that, you know, there's always a part of a game that even when you have a great team like we had, there's always parts of games that you need that goaltender to make the saves and the, you know, power play and stuff like that.
So how much communication, you're the head coach in that period of time, how much communication would you have with your starting goaltender, particularly one that was, let's face it, a little different than most goalies?
I would say we never talked about goaltending. We didn't have a goalie coach.
Right.
The one thing I do remember, we had probably the strangest conversation is, it might have been the year of 76-77, because we lost one game at home on Halloween night, and then we won all the rest of the home games. But, you know, we had a backup goalie. I mean, when you think about it, Michel Larocque was drafted number 6 in the 72 draft. I mean, so he was obviously the number one goalie available. And I guess it was with somebody else's pick again, because we drafted Steve Schutt in that same draft on the third pick. So we had, you know, we always had so many picks. So the sixth pick, Bunny Larocque and Michelle, he started to play 20, 25 games a year. And then in January, most seasons, I know the last two or three, Ken always had to take off about two and a half weeks with a, it was called tall back syndrome. You know, he was 6'4", and started to play Bunny Larocque, and he started to win. Naturally, the team was winning, and we kept winning. And Ken didn't play at home in the Forum for close to 2 months. And he went in my office one day. He said, "Scotty, I have to talk to you." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Well, you know, I don't want to be too assumption, but I assume I'm going to start the playoffs. Is there any chance I can play a game or two before the playoffs start?" And I hadn't thought of it. And I said, "Whoa, I never realized that." And I said, "Yeah, that we got to do that," because he was playing all the away games. But that would be that year 77 that we lost the 8 games and 2 in the playoffs.
So you talked about you didn't have hockey conversations. What would you talk about with Ken Dryden?
Well, he always had a busy schedule, and he did not want to miss games, and he also was a practice goalie. He wanted to practice. It was hard to get him out of the net. I mean, you know, he was cordial to both. Well, he started with Rogie Vachon, and then Michel Larocque became the backup for most of his career, like from 74 on. But we had some other goalies. The late Wayne Thomas was a goalie that was in there too, maybe the first year or two. So, I mean, he was always going somewhere. You know, he would ask me, "What time are we going to practice?" Because I switched the practices around. I didn't like the idea after games of practicing at 10 o'clock. So I moved them to noon. So he was always talking to me about his schedule, because he was still taking courses at McGill. And, you know, he's always doing something. I think that's one thing about playing goal. He probably never had to think much about the games, because he played most of the games, and he had so much other stuff that he had to do, and so, I mean, you know, he was a busy man, and he continued that, and he took a long time to do things, and the same thing with my book. Like, you know, when he called me and said, "We got to make sure that people know what, you know, you're getting on in age." I was 86 or something. And I said, "Well, I don't have time for a book. I can't do that." And then he convinced me. And he said, "Well, I got a better plan." And he said, "Scotty, we don't have to, there's no rush." But he said, "I know you go to Florida." He said, "You know, why don't we just do it during the hockey season from October till, say, March?" And he planned it all out. And I said, "Look, we'll try it." And we would, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, except for American Thanksgiving and Christmas time, we took a little time off. I would call him at 9, or he'd call me. And we were talking from 2 to 2.5 to 3 hours a couple of times. We never got off the phone, but he recorded everything. And we did that for 3 years. That's how much research he did. And then I thought we were all done. I enjoyed doing it because he was so thorough. Came down a couple of times. He came to East Amherst in the summer once. But I didn't know. I said, well, Ken, you know, it's got to be coming pretty close to the end. Well, one more chapter, Scotty. I got an idea. He said, we're going to need a little more time. I said, well, what's that? He said, well, you got your history there, but I want to do a series on the six best teams, in my opinion, that are on records. And he picked them all. I don't know them all right now. I know a few of them. Edmonton, obviously. The 52 Red Wings was another one of the Chicago teams of that six. So he said, we're going to have a playoff with six teams. So he matched them up, and I had to coach both teams. But I mean, it's in the book, but it took a while because I had to figure out, you know, so naturally at the end, I mean, I looked at all the teams. It was close. And I think we ended up beating the big Oiler team. It was close, and we won. And of course, the 76-77 team was hard to beat, you know.
Would he go down as really the first big goaltender in hockey?
I'm trying to recall goalies. Charlie Rayner was a good-sized goalie a long time ago in the 50s. A goalie that didn't play a lot with Toronto. He played more with Minnesota. He's 6'3", Cesar Maniago.
Right.
But most of the goalies that I know of, like when we're talking Montreal, you know, Bill Dernan was a fairly good sized goalie, but not like Ken. But then when you get into the Charlie Hodge, Jerry McNeil, Jacques Plante was about 5'11", I think Jacques was, and Glenn would probably be. Glenn Hall was close to that. But nothing like 6'4". No.
No. I'm just curious, when your discussion with the book and his post-playing career, because you guys both left Canadians at the same time after beating the Rangers in the Stanley Cup final in 1979. Would you suggest you knew Ken better in the last 30 years as you did when you were coaching him?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, we kept in touch, but nothing. I mean, I'd see him at different events, but then when the book thing came up, we became very friendly, and I had to call him a lot on different things and research, get some pictures. And, you know, he went down, he visited where I grew up. I mean, he was very thorough. I mean, there was nothing, he left no stone unturned, because anytime I would mention something, he definitely verified it. And, so that was what he was like. He was always, he had like a mind that planned ahead and was not taking anything for granted, didn't skip over anything, you know. So he was well planned out.
Well, how will you remember him?
Oh, I mean, two ways. As a goaltender, and I had so many great goaltenders. I got so fortunate in my career. I mean, you know, when you think about the goalies that I had, even going into we went to Pittsburgh the second year when I coached Tom Barrasso. He was a wonderful goalie in Buffalo. What a story. He was a rookie coming out of high school, winning all those trophies at the beginning, and then he ended up in Pittsburgh winning the two cups. And then, you know, with Detroit getting, we struggled early, and the big change in Detroit, besides getting the trade, when we did make the trade to get Brendan Shanahan, and we also picked up, we picked up a lot of players at the time, but Mike Vernon was a big addition for us, because with Patrick Roy in Colorado, he was a tough goalie. He was a money goalie. He could, especially a young goalie at the other end, playing in a series and matching up against Patrick, and Mike Vernon had beat him once before. He had beat him in 89 in Montreal and lost in 86 to Patrick. So he came in and he only played the 1 year, but he was really solid with Mike, with Chris Osgood. They were a good tandem. And then Chris Osgood won 400 games. He played the second year, second cup. And then Dominic Hasek, I mean, and then you know, starting my career with Glenn Hall first for 1 year alone and then Jacques Plante for two more with Glenn. I mean, you can't look at goalies in the league and say, I mean, I know how you win games, and if you don't have a goaltender, I mean, we know what Sergei Bobrovsky has meant to the Florida Panthers with many other things, but the goaltender, Kenny was just, I mean, he was so steady. As I said, except for the 3 weeks he'd missed in January, he never had a serious injury. He liked to practice. And I think it was like the confidence that he gave a Hall of Fame team. You know, there was never any thought. And I've seen comments by players, never any thought, well, is their goalie going to be the difference? Because they said, we know he is. So especially, I remember like watching that series. I was in St. Louis when that series went on. And oh my goodness! I mean, I've seen a lot of fantastic goaltending, but boy, that 7-game series. I mean, if you could rehearse it again, and as a person, he was pretty touching. He was always interested in my family. He was interested. He was always asking. I always asked about my handicap son, David, and you know when Stan got into difficulties in the league, you know he was asking questions and trying to, you know, saying, well, he had a good philosophy on life, Ken did. And this was, I understand he's been sick for a couple of years, but what I understand is that he just didn't want to spend, he knew for he had 2 years left in his life and he lived it the way he wanted to. He didn't want it to be a daily situation with him. I understand. People wondered why it happened, but he kept it to his family. And mm-hmm. Linda sent me we were pretty close to, my wife was very friendly with Linda. She sat at games in the forum. Linda was one of the wives that my wife had a very good understanding with. And Linda sent the text to some friends at 9 o'clock on Friday. And I was shocked like everybody. And first call I made, I called Serge Savard because he's been very instrumental with this. He's kind of not taken over, but he's that 72 Summit series, which he only played half the series, but Serge has really been the quarterback in a lot of the events that take place, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you for this, Scotty. I appreciate your time. It's a sad weekend. Reflecting on what a great person Ken Dryden was.
Yeah, well, thank you for the interview, and we'll miss him for sure. You know, I mean, he taught me a lot, and I was so happy that you know, he did the book for me, and I wouldn't have been able to do a book because, like, I think he did a great job. Thanks.
The one and only Scotty Bowman, back with Alan Walsh after this. 100% Hockey returns on this special edition on the life and times of Ken Dryden, joined now by Octagon agent, super agent, Alan Walsh, who, quite frankly, isn't here today to talk about being an agent. He's here to talk about being, A, a Montrealer, and B, a fan of Ken Dryden. And, Alan, perhaps you can tell people the impact Ken Dryden has had on your life.
He was my childhood idol. And growing up in Montreal, there were lots of Ken Dryden fans. There were lots of fans of the Montreal Canadiens. I mean, basically everybody was a fan of the Montreal Canadiens. But I would venture to guess that there was no greater Ken Dryden fan than me. Starting in around 71, 72, my entire bedroom was just a tribute to Dryden, posters, pictures. Starting around 72, I started a scrapbook that contained, it was known as the Ken Dryden scrapbook. And I painstakingly cut out every Dryden article from the Montreal Gazette, the Montreal Star, the Sunday Express, the Journal de Montréal, the Dimanche Matin. there wasn't anything I didn't seek out, especially on Sundays, the day after the Saturday Montreal Canadiens game, to cut out any mention of Dryden, put it in the scrapbook. It got filled up around 1976, so I started a second one, and I still have them both to this day. I have to say they are prized possessions of my childhood, and there's a story about the scrapbook that I can get to. My dad was pretty ill around the year of the Halak run in Montreal. And I took my son with me. He must have been about 8 years old at the time, to Montreal for the playoffs. And the Canadians were in the conference final against the Philadelphia Flyers after beating Pittsburgh and Washington in dramatic seven games. And my son went into the closet in my old bedroom and came out holding this big scrapbook and said, "Dad, what's this?" And I told him all about Ken Dryden. We sat together. He sat on my lap. I opened up the scrapbook. And he was turning each page and asking about this photo, this article. And he could see I wrote little notes when I was 8, 9 years old next to the photos. And he was just enthralled with it all. So we go to the game that night. And after the game, we're in the elevator at the Bell Center going down to the event level where the dressing rooms are to see Yarrow Halak and a few other clients after the game. And when we got down to the event level, the elevator doors open and Ken Dryden is standing there. No. And he says, "Hello, Alan, how are you?" We shake hands and I say, "Ethan," I look down at my son, "this is Ken Dryden." And Ethan has a look of wonder on his face. And Ken says, "Hello, Ethan," and bends down and shakes his hand. Ken gets on the elevator. We get off. And as we're walking, Ethan was silent for about 10 seconds. And then he looks up at me and he says, "Wow, Dad, I just met your childhood hero." Mm. And there are no greater, truer words than that.
Wow. But you met Ken Dryden as a child as well, didn't you?
I met Ken Dryden as a seven-year-old. What happened was I came down with appendicitis and ultimately needed surgery. And during the surgery, my appendix burst. And a lot of the poison inside the appendix got into my intestines. I ended up spending about 4 weeks in the hospital after the surgery. And I remember waking up from the surgery and my dad is standing over me. And he said, "Alan, what's the one thing you want most in the world when you get healthy and get out of the hospital? I'm going to get it for you." And I said, "Dad, the only thing I want is to meet Ken Dryden." And somehow, I don't know how, my father, in 1973, found a way to contact Ken Dryden, explain to him the story. And Ken said, "You tell your son when he's healthy and out of the hospital, I'd love to invite you and him together down to the forum for practice. And I'd love to meet your son."
Wow.
So I had great motivation now to get healthy. And when I got home, my dad called him again. They arranged a day where we would go down to the forum for practice. We waited at the security desk St. Catherine and Atwater and de Maisonneuve. Atwater and de Maisonneuve on the there was the security desk right there. And he arrived for practice, and I ran to him and I threw my arms around his thigh and I started crying. And he looked down at me and said, "Mr. Walsh, I presume?" And I looked up at him, cried, "Yes." And he started talking to me, and I stopped crying, brought me into practice. After practice, he sought me out, brought me into the Canadiens dressing room, introduced me one by one. We went around the entire Canadiens dressing room, meeting every player on the team and getting their autograph in a white autograph book that I had. Brought me into Scotty Bowman's office, sat down across the desk from Scotty and had a conversation, me, Scotty, and Ken. And it was probably one of the most memorable days of my life. I still have that white autograph book, by the way, as well.
You're going to have to donate this stuff at some point, you know. six Stanley Cups in eight seasons as Canadiens goaltender. But I would argue, and I think that others would agree, that his impact off the ice may be greater than his impact on the ice. Would that be fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, I'm biased, as you all know, but he was an incredible goalie. He was majestic in the net. I was attracted, even as a young boy, as much to the way he stopped pucks as to his intellect. From the earliest memory, people would ask me, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I always said, "I want to be an NHL player and I want to be a lawyer like Ken Dryden." That was my answer. And I was never good enough to become an NHL player, but I've represented a few along the way and I did become a lawyer.
Yes, you did. And you too have made an impact on the game. And I think that Ken would probably understand that. How many times have you read the game?
Probably over 50. I would periodically go back to it at times twice a year and read it cover to cover. It is the greatest book, in my opinion, ever written by a former player about the game they played. Every single page captures observations and the way he processed what was going on around him and the way he explained what was going on, not only in the game itself, but the subtext is knowing that it was his last year. Mm-hmm. And he was hanging on to every story, every observation. When he talked about how he put it together, he would grab scraps of paper when thoughts would come to him and write a note and stuff them in his pocket. And he'd have 15, 20 pieces of paper stuffed into his pocket at the end of the day that he then saved later. Took his family and moved to England, where he spent a year putting all these scraps of paper together to tell the story of the game.
Well, I will tell you one story from my connection with Ken. So we worked together at Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment for 3 or 4 years. And when he announced his departure from the company to go run for office for the Liberal Party, I walked into his office and said, congratulations. He and I fought like cats and dogs a lot about philosophy, which was great. I think we both enjoyed it. And I said, "Why are you doing this now?" And he said, "My mom and dad taught me a long time ago, at a certain point, you have to give back, you know, and I'm at a point in my life and I am at a point in my career. I've done enough in hockey. Now I have to start to give back." And that's, in fact, what he did. He did that, I think, with the game. I think he did it with his other writings, and he certainly did that working and being in public office. He was an eclectic guy. He was a bit of an enigma, but he made an impact on the game, and he made an impact on Canadians, didn't he?
He sure did. And you know, there was always an element of reluctance about him. He was one of the first players, the natural progression for his hockey, where he was as a teenager, would be going to play major junior. And instead, he pursued his education at Cornell University and NCAA. Had a legendary career there. Mm-hmm. And then when the Canadians acquired his rights, well, they wanted to sign him and get him into the system. I think Sam Pollock had an idea of what his goaltending potential was, but Dryden said no. And he accepted a position with the Canadian national team, and that was based in Winnipeg, and enrolled at University of Manitoba Law School. So he's going to law school, and he's playing for the national team. And it was only when the national team disbanded, now he's got nowhere to play hockey, that the Canadians came back to him again and said, we want to sign you. And he said, I'm not willing to give up studying law. So they came up with a plan together. And this is Sam Pollock, who isn't known for being very flexible with what individual players want, especially a player not in the NHL, who may never play in the NHL. So they came up with a plan where Ken would sign with the Canadiens. He would transfer from the University of Manitoba to McGill University Law School in Montreal, and he would only play home games with the Montreal Voyageurs, right, who were the Canadiens' AHL farm team at the time. He, during that season, agreed, once he felt comfortable that his studies wouldn't suffer, going on road trips only as far as Quebec City. and ultimately, had a very good run with the Montreal Voyageurs, who played at the Forum,
right
in the afternoon of a lot of nights when the Canadians were playing, at 8:30 p.m. Saturday nights, right, which is when the game started back then. Hockey Night, and when Hockey Night, as you well know, is when Hockey Night in Canada started.
I remember that show.
So, yeah, you do. Dryden gets called up at the end of the 70-71 season to the Canadians. Plays his first NHL game in Pittsburgh. They win 5-1 on the road, and ended up playing 6 games. And in the 6 games, only allowed 9 goals. Al McNeil's the head coach of the Canadiens. It's expected by everybody that Rogge Vachon will be starting in the net in the quarterfinals against the vaunted Boston Bruins, who were the favorites to win the cup. They were the defending champs. And Al McNeil shocked the hockey world by starting Ken Dryden in the net, who went on to lead the Canadians on this miracle, mystical Stanley Cup run that ended with a 3-2 win against Chicago in Chicago Stadium to win the cup and Dryden the Conn Smythe Trophy.
Well, that might have been, that looked like the right out of the scrapbook. Right out of the scrapbook, Alan. And by the way, you would have also appreciated Kenny when he decided not to play a year because he was not very happy with what was going on with his career.
And his this is important because there's a lot of misinformation out there that I've been reading the last day or two about that year. What happened was after the Canadians won the cup in 73, it was Ken's second cup in 3 years. He won the Vezina Trophy. He was named to the first team All-Star, NHL All-Star team. There was no salary disclosure at the time. Players didn't know what other players were making, and that's the way the NHL wanted it. But Ken went on his own and did an investigation and discovered that there were six or seven goalies in the NHL making more money than he was. Now, he had another year remaining on his contract with the Canadians. He's under contract. Mm-hmm. But he went in, met with Sam Pollock, and he said, "Sam, I want to renegotiate my contract now. I've won two cups, Vezina Trophy, first team All-Star. I want to be paid the and the words that Ken used in that meeting, I want to be paid the going rate." And Sam said, "I have a policy against renegotiating contracts. You are going to play this coming year under your current contract. And when it is over, we will then talk about your next contract." Well, under his, you know, and at the time, the World Hockey Association had come on the scene in 72. Mm-hmm. And lots of players whose contracts were expired were jumping to the WHA. And of course, the most famous one to get the league rolling was Bobby Hull.
Sure.
From Chicago. And there was a team in Toronto, the Toronto Toros, mm-hmm. owned by John Bassett.
Correct.
Okay. So under his contract, he couldn't jump to the WHA. All he could really do was, quote unquote, retire. So he notified the Canadians that he was retiring, which would allow the contract to run during the year of retirement. And he moved his family to Toronto, and in Toronto took a job articling. He had graduated from law school. He had graduated from McGill, but you must article for 1 year before being eligible to write the bar exam. So he's articling in Toronto at a law firm called Hoskins, Harcourt, Osler, Hoskins, and Harcourt. Mm-hmm. Osler, Hoskins, and Harcourt. And he's articling at that firm for $135 a week and did some color commentary on Toronto Toros broadcasts.
That's right, on global television.
That's right. And the Canadians took a major step back in the 73-74 season with a rookie, Bunny LaRocque, Michel Plasse, and Wayne Thomas. The team lost in the quarterfinals, first round of the playoffs, to the New York Rangers. And it was around that time. First of all, the whole year, I missed Dryden. Many people thought that his hockey career was over, that nobody really understood what had happened, why he left, that it was over a contract negotiation, renegotiation that Sam wouldn't do. When the Canadians came to Toronto that season, Ken came to the game. He may have broadcast the game. I'm not aware of that. He went down to the dressing room and saw the players. And it was that coming into the room and seeing the soap bars flying everywhere after the game and everyone like happy to see it. He missed it.
Yeah.
He missed it. And broadcasting Toronto Toro games, John Bassett was desperately wanting to sign him for the Toros at the end of the year. With the sparse crowds, he became disillusioned with the WHA as an option for him. He was going to get the year of articling done. I wrote Ken a 12-page letter as a 9-year-old to the law firm in Toronto. Ken Dryden, care of Osler, Hoskins, and Harcourt, telling him how much everybody in Montreal missed him and begging him to come back to the Canadiens. And I probably sent it beginning of June mm-hmm. of 1974. And about mid-June, I think the date was around June 18, Ken wrote me a letter back thanking me for my letter and for my comments. And at the end, put a sentence, "I'm looking forward to playing with the Canadiens again, Ken Dryden." And I got that letter. I read it. I had chills going up and down my body. And I remember my dad was standing next to me like, "What does it say? What does it say?" I said, "Dad, he's coming back to the Canadiens." This is before social media.
I was going to say, if you tweeted that out, Alan, you'd have the scoop of the year.
I was 9 years old and I had the biggest scoop in the NHL.
Listen, I don't mind saying you and I are dear friends. And on Friday night, when we got the news of Ken's passing just after midnight Eastern time, the first person I thought of was you and sent you a note. And I know the impact that he made on your life. And I want to thank you for sharing some of those stories with us.
You got it. My pleasure. Anytime.
Alan Walsh, who followed Scotty Bowman and Dave Stubbs on this special edition of 100% Hockey as we celebrate the life and times of Ken Dryden.